Brian Lehrer on WNYC. With a cabinet full of businessmen and generals being selected by Donald Trump, there's a very interesting article in The Atlantic right now by a woman who has written extensively about different kinds of leadership and who has the unusual perspective of teaching literature to cadets at West Point. Maybe you already know the work of Elizabeth Sammet, including her book Soldier's Heart, Reading Literature Through Peace and War at West Point, and her Norton anthology called Leadership, Essential Writings by Our Greatest Thinkers. Her Atlantic article is called Business Leaders and the Mixed Feelings They Inspire. And it suggests that one reason Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton is that the public sees virtue in the selfishness of business leaders, but it's a vice in public servants. Professor Sammet, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Brian. It's nice to be with you again.
Can I get right to that paradox to start? Can you elaborate on that idea that Trump's life of self-dealing was okay with a lot of people, while much less of it by Hillary Clinton was seen as acceptable?
Sure. And let me just preface it by saying that these are my personal opinions rather than necessarily representing where I work. So, yes, it's a strange paradox. Of course, we were told throughout the campaign that what the country needed was leadership. And then it turns out that we seem to expect very, very different things from political leaders and seem to manifest great outrage when those leaders don't measure up to some expectation we have of public virtue. And yet it seems that leaders who come from the private sector, at least one way to explain how things turned out is to suggest that we really don't have any expectations about virtue or a sense of investment in the common good, but that instead we sort of take it for granted that self-interest is the sort of hallmark of successful business people. And that may be true in some cases, may not, but that seems to be sort of one way to account for this.
You use the example of Trump's boast that avoiding taxes made him smart. Clinton could never have done that.
Right. And those things she was criticized for seem to be manifestations of a kind of self-interest. So taking fees for speaking engagements and doing all the sorts of things that people in other walks of life wouldn't necessarily be criticized for seem to me somehow in the rhetoric a compromise. But in someone from whom we expect self-interest, because we number that among the qualities of successful economic success, that didn't seem to be a factor.
And I guess the public then has to trust that he's going to use all those techniques on our behalf, and that somehow it's easier for people to do that when it comes to a businessman who's been self-dealing than a politician.
I think the whole notion that the system is rigged opens up the possibility that or the idea that who would be best suited, I mean, this is how the logic goes, that someone who knows that and knows how to work the system. But it's sort of an interesting paradox that the expectation also has to be that self-interest, or what we assume to be self-interest, now sort of magically metamorphoses into public interest.
So you're contrasting how politicians and business people are seen in these regards. You teach at West Point. How would the perception of military leaders by their troops or by the public fit into that paradigm?
Well, that's another interesting question. So for as I note in the article, for centuries, especially in the ancient period, political and military leaders were regarded, I mean, they often fulfilled both functions, for example, in ancient Greece or ancient Rome. So someone who was a general one day was a consul the next. And that idea of translating military leadership into political leadership and being adept at both was sort of standard. Now we have, I think, a different sense in that I think the notion of military professionalism is something that has grown up as a distinct idea, and that both the political and the military leader are public servants, but their realms are often so different that I think there are specialized skills that are required. And it's interesting that the transition here from military to civilian leadership and how that will play out, especially the question of waivers in certain cases and the idea of civilian control over the military, which is, of course, something that, that pundits have been talking about a great deal.
And much of your 20-page Atlantic article is so interesting because it's a history of the tension between virtue and wealth. And you go way back to contrast the banning of trade in ancient Sparta because trade was seen as working against virtue versus Julius Caesar, who said the German tribes of his day were successful in part because they were familiar with imported goods. Has this ebbed and flowed over the entire history of the West?
This has been a dominant tension that comes into play often when there is some kind of economic revolution. So I think if we think about the beginnings of capitalism and the financial revolutions of Enlightenment Europe, for example, these issues really came to the fore, especially with the idea of public credit, of national banks, which is also was the great one of the great sticking points of the United States founding period, and what a national bank.
Alexander Hamilton, as anybody who's seen the play knows, was portrayed in that, right?
Right.
Wanting the national bank, public credit for private interests, but seen in the as being in the national good by Alexander Hamilton, Jefferson not so much.
Right. The idea that Hamilton's idea of how the public good could be secured juxtaposed to Jefferson, who rooted his notions of virtue in an agrarian world and suggested that actually working the land and agriculture were inherently virtuous. And he contrasted that to the mobs who lived in cities. And they were seen instead, he writes, the mobs of great cities add just so much to the support of pure government as sores do to the strength of the human body. So he had fairly fixed opinions about that.
Listeners, any questions or thoughts for Elizabeth Sammet? Her Atlantic article is Business Leaders and the Mixed Feelings They Inspire. Maybe you know her other works like Soldier's Heart, Reading Literature Through Peace and War at West Point, that much acclaimed book. She teaches literature at West Point. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And we'll come back to Trump and what might happen in the next few years in this country. But staying on some of the history, you point out that relatively contemporary books on leadership, from Machiavelli's The Prince to Peter Drucker's popular management books, say your success, your personal success in business, should be rooted in society's success. How is that not a stretch or fiction, considering the main goals of Machiavelli, really in government, Machiavelli, and of Drucker in business, are to maximize personal wealth or personal power?
Well, I think that's a tension that runs throughout Drucker's work and anyone who writes on business, and also in business schools, with the notion of the perennial temptations of near-term profit balanced against the idea that as a part of society, Drucker calls business an organ of society, that the health of the body is essential to the health of the organ in that case. But I think that there's always the sense in which that near-term profit or answering the demands of one's stakeholders is a different proposition. And sometimes there's a conflict between the definition of good for an individual entity, a private entity, commercial or otherwise, and that of the government at large, the people at large.
One of Trump's main lines and main paradoxes is that he says companies should take American workers' interests, patriotic public good, into account before they decide to move jobs overseas for greater profits, even though his and his daughter's clothing lines are made so much in poor foreign countries. Talk about business leaders inspiring mixed feelings. Does that kind of embody some of the tensions you write about?
I think that there's always that particular tension in that when you define good according to an economic profit, that and to a kind of efficiency that is inherent to certain business practices, that often runs antithetical. I mean, that's sometimes the source of frustration of government, right? That it moves so slowly, that it costs so much money. Why can't we just do this more easily and streamline this? But all of those inefficiencies are, of course, built into the government system in many ways. That doesn't mean in some respects it can't be made more efficient. Goodness knows it can. But that some of the inefficiencies and the slowness are those very protections that help it to work, particularly in a democracy. And there are certain, I think there are certain functions that the government performs that we would want the government to perform rather than an individual private entity.
212-433-WNYC and Catherine in Patterson. You're on WNYC with Elizabeth Samet. Hi, Catherine.
Oh, hi, Brian. Thanks for taking the call. Elizabeth, I'm just wondering, I think it's a fascinating take, and you certainly have an interesting angle due to your occupation, and I would like to look at the article. But for me, this election really highlighted how a man can overstep his bounds in a million ways, and a woman just simply can't. And I thought it was so black and white and so clear that Hillary Clinton, she was never going to win. There was no way she could satisfy our notion of female virtuosity and walk this tight line and make it into a position of such extreme power. Whereas Donald Trump, it's almost a stuff of fiction. He could do anything. Anything at all and get away with it. So while I appreciate your viewpoint, I wonder what you think about that.
Thanks, Catherine. I focused in the piece, of course, on this notion of business, but I don't think that at all negates your point that gender certainly played a role. It played a role in all of the rhetoric, I think, surrounding the campaign. And I do think we have different notions, both historically and today, about women and virtue. And often they are clouded by other discussions of emotion and of, I mean, if you recall, there were times when Hillary Clinton was accused of not caring and not showing emotion, and then it seemed that she could never satisfy people on that point, and those aren't questions that people ask of men in general. So I do think that all of the campaigning was certainly freighted with gender differences.
And I guess a thought experiment along the lines of your article on Catherine's call might be, if, let's say, Carly Fiorina was the Republican candidate, the business person who had, let's say she had all the same excesses that, some wouldn't apply, but a lot of them as a business person could apply as Donald Trump, and that braggadocio about it and that attitude toward it, versus maybe Tim Kaine, if he was the nominee, a male Democrat, would he not have the wiggle room of a Carly Fiorina if the gender and party shoes were on the other feet? I guess there's just no way to know.
Right. That would be the laboratory experiment that we would have to sort of figure out what in fact were the determining factors ultimately.
Greg in Princeton Junction, you're on WNYC. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how are you? Thank you very much for taking the call.
Sure.
My question, I don't know how appropriate it is, but it's the distinction between religious values and business values. I don't know what percentage of people who are evangelicals or Christians would have voted for Trump, where Christianity and capitalism, no matter how effective it is as an economic, does have a conflict. One is to accumulate for yourself, and the other is really sharing with others.
Right, and I think that has been an important facet of the American debate about virtue and commerce, really, from the colonial period. The idea that Puritan values, for example, including hard work and diligence, could be used, and the historian Bernard Balin made this point many years ago, could be used by the merchant, and profit could then become a proof of those virtues, but it could also be used by the church to suggest that, in fact, the community was not being benefited and that these were sort of self-interested people more concerned with making money than with the health of the community. So I think that has been used successfully on both sides of that argument.
Let's see if I can get George in Huntington up here. No, that line is not. Oh, there we go. George in Huntington. Now we have you. You're on WNYC.
Yeah, hi. How you guys doing?
Okay.
Very interested listening to you. My question is, Trump's background, he is a graduate of West Point. Was he in your guest's class at any time? And how his training at West Point might relate to his business acumen?
Oh, interesting. Now, I don't think our guest is old enough to have taught Donald Trump at West Point.
No, he did not attend West Point.
Oh, where did he go? He was in some military academy, right?
I think the New York Military Academy for a time.
But not West Point.
Sure. Yeah. Right.
Well, how was he, if I may ask, and I realize, and you made it very clear at the beginning of the segment, that you're here representing your personal views, not anything about the institution where you teach, West Point. But I think Trump has a lot of support in the military. I wonder how you would describe the predominant reactions to him among your students at West Point.
I think probably my political science colleagues would have a better window into this because, of course, they're teaching about elections and about the political process.
And you teach literature.
Yes, right. So, I think that my students are very attuned to all of the issues that have surrounded the debate, all of the rhetoric, because I do teach literature. They're very attuned to language. And while I haven't discussed the election in specifics with them, I do think that they have a very clear sense that the language we use to describe power, to describe the United States, to describe its role in the world, has very particular repercussions for them and for their careers. So I think, like college students everywhere, they have different personal politics, but they also have a very robust and mature sense of professionalism as well. And of course, for military professionals, that has some very particular attributes.
So I think that's a nice academic way of saying a lot of the students were aghast at the way Trump would demean different people and groups of people and things like that. Yes or no?
I think that all of the language that has emerged in this campaign has had something in it to offend everyone. I mean, and it's not just the candidates, but it's the language that I see and hear everywhere, and that you do as well. And I know you've spent a lot of time on your show talking about it, but it seems now that it's sort of anyone is fair game, and that there have been so many wounding things said that I think it'll be a long time to repair a lot of the damage done in terms of public discourse.
Kathy on the New Jersey Turnpike. You're on WNYC with Elizabeth Samet. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I just want to connect, like, the earlier caller the earlier guest about Russia and Rex Tillerson, what he said about Rex Tillerson just at the end. I'd like to know, how will we as the public be able to measure how and when Rex Tillerson's actions shift from driven by profit to being driven by public interest? What kind of indicators do we need to look to point to him evolving into the role of Secretary of State? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks. And that's a great question for Elizabeth, who wrote an article all about the mixed feelings that people have toward business leaders when it comes to their potential roles as public servants. How would you measure?
Right. I don't know that there is a clear measurement. So I guess that with any business leader, there might be lingering suspicions about motive and profit. But I think it's too easy on the one hand to suggest that anyone involved, I mean, people shift back from business to politics all the time in many different guises. So on the one hand, I think it's naive to say that people involved in business are inevitably corrupt and incapable of transcending personal interest or economic interest. On the other hand, to say that they are naturally virtuous and that they will immediately understand the public interest, I mean, I think this is one of those moments where experience is actually very helpful, and certain kinds of experience can be had in the public, in government, that can't really be had in the private sector. So I think there will be a learning curve for many people used to operating private corporations, even on an international level, and then sort of setting one's sights in a different direction.
Yeah, and the caller and your answer make me think that today Trump is meeting with Silicon Valley CEOs like Tim Cook of Apple and Jeff Bezos of Amazon and Ginni Rometty of IBM. And it's interesting to me that in this case, potentially at least, Trump will represent the public virtue of trying to get them to make some Apple products in the United States or not automate cashiers out of existence as Amazon plans to do, and it opens some stores, things like that. This time the supposedly progressive tech sector might come out the money-grubbing private ones compared to Trump, despite what we know Trump has been all his life. Have you thought about the roles the two sides have in this particular meeting?
I haven't thought about it in terms of that meeting specifically, but it certainly is a case where so many of our assumptions about the way that the economy works and about our really post-World War II understanding of the importance of manufacturing to the American economy, and so many of the changes that technology and globalization have wrought, that sometimes we have people sort of on the other side of the debate, and that the debate really, part of the issue is that the debate really needs to change. And I think so many of our ideas of economic success are rooted in models that are really outmoded, and that it's a fantasy to think that the sort of old alignments will reemerge.
Elizabeth Samet teaches literature at West Point. She's the author of books, including the widely acclaimed Soldier's Heart, Reading Literature Through Peace and War at West Point. Her new Atlantic article is called Business Leaders and the Mixed Feelings They Inspire. Thank you so much.
It was wonderful to be with you again, Brian. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.